It's also instructive to look at the copies of the painting made in his workshop. It has always been thought that Leonardo's pupils and assistants created these works by copying Leonardo's painting or his cartoons or even his drawings, Francesca Fiorani noted. But these copies were actually produced while the original was in the making, and they reflect alternative solutions Leonardo imagined for it. The painting. It is important, Leonardo wrote, to have a movement of a person's limbs appropriate to that person's mental movements. His painting of the Virgin and Child with St. Anne shows what he meant. Mary's right arm is stretched as she tries to restrain the Christ child, showing a protective but gentle love. But he is intent on wrestling with the lamb, his leg over its neck and his hands grappling with its head. The lamb, as Friar Pietro told us, represents the passion, Jesus' fate, and he will not be restrained from it. Both Mary and her mother look young, almost as if they were sisters, even though the apocryphal tale is that St. Anne was past childbearing age when Mary was born through a miracle. In the cartoon that Friar Pietro described, Leonardo portrayed St. Anne looking older. We know this because even though that cartoon was lost, there was a good copy of it. The copy was itself lost in Budapest during World War II, but photographs and etchings of it exist. They show that Leonardo had conceived of St. Anne as an older woman wearing a matronly cloth headdress. By the time he got around to executing the final painting, he had changed his mind. He made St. Anne look much younger. In the painting, her torso and that of her daughter seem fused as they dote on the young child. The image of a squirming boy with what looks like two mothers conjures up Leonardo's own childhood, being raised by both his birth mother, Caterina, and his slightly younger stepmother. Freud made much of this, writing, "Leonardo gave the boy two mothers, the one who stretched out her arms after him and another who is seen in the background. Both are represented with the blissful smile of maternal happiness. Leonardo's childhood was precisely as remarkable as this picture. He had two mothers." Freud goes on to discern the shape of a vulture lying sideways in the picture composition. But since he got the name of the bird wrong, it seems to reflect Freud's fantasy more than Leonardo's. Underneath the feet and elegant toes of St. Anne, we can see, as in the Louvre version of Virgin of the Rocks, how Leonardo's studies of geology informed his paintings. In one of his notebooks, he described what is now known as graded bedding in layers of sedimentary rock. Each layer is composed of heavier and lighter parts, the lowest being the heaviest. And the reason for this is that these layers are formed by the sediments from the waters discharged into the sea by the current of the rivers that flow into it. The heaviest part of this sediment was the part that was discharged first in the sequence. The stratified rock formations and perfectly variegated pebbles beneath St. Anne's feet portray this phenomenon accurately. Leonardo had also been wrestling with the question of why the sky appears blue, and around that time he had correctly concluded that it had to do with the water vapor in the air. In the St. Anne painting, he portrays the sky's luminous and misty gradations of blue as no other painter had done. The recent cleaning of the painting fully reveals the magic realism veiled in vapors of his distant mountains and skyline. Most significant, the painting conveys the paramount theme in Leonardo's art, the spiritual connection and analogy between the earth and humans. Echoing so many of his paintings, Ginevra de' Benci, Virgin of the Rocks, Madonna of the Yarn Winder, and of course, the Mona Lisa, a river curls from the distant horizon of the macrocosm of the earth and seems to flow into the veins of the Holy Family, ending with the lamb that foreshadows the Passion. The curving flow of the river connects to the flowing composition of the characters. As Vespucci's marginal note informs us, Leonardo had completed the central part of the painting by 1503. But he never delivered it to the Church of Santissima Annunziata. Instead, he carried it with him for the rest of his life, making improvements on it for more than a decade. During those years, his assistants and students made copies based on the work in progress and on Leonardo's sketches. Some are actually more finished than the painting Leonardo left us, and they allow us to see various details, such as jeweled sandals on the feet of St. Anne, and ornate embroidery on her clothes that Leonardo was considering or had sketched but never got around to painting. The St. Anne is the most complex and layered of Leonardo's panel paintings, and many see it as a masterpiece on a par with the Mona Lisa, perhaps even surpassing it, because it is more complex in its composition and motion. We are always discovering new felicities of movement and harmony, growing more and more intricate, yet subordinate to the whole, wrote Kenneth Clark. And, as with Bach, this is not only an intellectual performance, it is charged with human feeling. Perhaps. The painting's grandeur, brilliant colour, and narrative movement are wondrous to behold. But a few elements of the masterpiece make it less than perfectly satisfying, at least to me. There is a slight artificiality in the poses. The bodies seem to swivel unnaturally, with the Virgin Mary awkwardly draped onto her mother's lap. St. Anne's jutting left arm seems uncomfortably cocked, and Mary's sunlit right shoulder is too broad and prominent. As I stand before the brightly restored painting in the Louvre, I find myself respecting and admiring it, but not being mesmerized the way I am by the two nearby masterpieces, St. John the Baptist and the Mona Lisa. There's a profound beauty to the picture, but Leonardo at his best also produces emotional connections tinged with mystery. In the St. Anne, the eyes of the characters do not seem to be windows into their souls, their smiles do not linger with us, hinting at elusive emotions. Then something interesting happens. I go back to London to see the Burlington House cartoon again in the soft-lit grotto where it is kept in the National Gallery. Even without the misty blue mountains and watery landscape, it has elements that, to me at least, are more interesting. In it, St. Anne's left arm is not unnaturally cocked, but instead, her sketched hand points to heaven, Leonardo's quintessential and exhilarating gesture. After a few experimental lines, he has succeeded in rendering the Virgin's right shoulder masterfully. As St. Anne glances lovingly yet quizzically at the Virgin, who is in turn glancing lovingly but warily at her child, there seems to be a greater depth of emotion than in the final painting. So maybe there was another reason Leonardo decided not to finish some of his works. The unpainted renderings of the Adoration of the Magi and the Burlington House St. Anne cartoon both have an unfinished perfection to them. For most people, unfinished perfection would seem to be a contradiction in terms, but sometimes it suits Leonardo. Among other things, he was the master of the unfinished. Vespucci was correct when he said that Leonardo was the new Apelles in that regard. Chapter 22. Paintings Lost and Found. Leda and the Swan. One of the veils blurring our knowledge of Leonardo is the mystery surrounding the authenticity and dates of some of his paintings, including ones we think are lost and others we think are finds. Like most artist-craftsmen of his era, he did not sign his work. Although he copiously documented trivial items in his notebooks, including the amount he spent on food and on Salai's clothes, he did not record what he was painting, what he had completed, and where his works went. For some paintings, we have detailed contracts and disputes to inform us. For others, we have to rely on a snippet from the sometimes reliable Vasari or other early chroniclers. That means we need to look at copies done by his followers to envision works now lost, such as the Battle of Anghiari, and to analyze what were thought to be works by his followers to see if they might actually be autographed Leonardo's. These endeavors can be frustrating, but even when they do not produce certainty, they can lead to a better understanding of Leonardo, as we saw in the case of La Bella Principessa. Leda and the Swan is the most tantalizing of Leonardo's lost paintings. The existence of multiple copies, including from students in his workshop, make it seem likely that he actually finished his own version. Lomazzo says that a nude Leda was one of Leonardo's few finished paintings, and there seems to be a report of it in 1625 at the French royal chateau of Fontainebleau, where a visitor described a standing figure of Leda almost totally naked, quasi tutta ignuda, with the swan at her side and two eggs, from whose broken shells come forth four babies. That sounds like Leonardo's purported painting, except that Leda, in both his own surviving preparatory drawing and in painted copies, was wholly naked. One tale, which is so delicious that it's a shame it's probably untrue, is that it was destroyed by Madame de Maintenon, the mistress and secret second wife of Louis XIV, because she found it too salacious. The myth of Leda and the swan tells how the Greek god Zeus assumed the form of a swan and seduced the beautiful mortal princess Leda. She produced two eggs, from which hatched two sets of twins, Helen, later known as Helen of Troy, and Clytemnestra, and Castor and Pollux. Leonardo's depiction focuses more on fertility than sex. Instead of painting the seduction scene, as others had done, he chose to portray the moment of the births, showing Leda caressing the swan as the four children squirm from their shells. One of the most vivid copies is by his pupil Francesco Melzi. See figure 81 in the PDF. When Leonardo was working on this painting during his second period in Florence in the early 1500s, he was doing his most intense studies on the flight of birds and also planning a test flight of one of his flying machines, which he hoped to launch from the top of nearby Swan Mountain, Monte Ceceri. His note about his childhood memory of a bird flying into his crib and flapping its tail in his mouth is also from this period. Leonardo produced a preparatory sketch of his planned painting sometime around 1505. See figure 82. It shows Leda kneeling and her body twisting as if writhing with joy as the swan nuzzles her. Leonardo's signature left-handed hatch lines are curved, a technique he started using in his machinery drawings of the 1490s and now used to show volume and modelling of curved surfaces. The technique is especially pronounced in Leda's opulent belly and the swan's breast. As usual with Leonardo, the drawing conveys a narrative. As the swan seductively nuzzles Leda, she points to what they have wrought, the children hatching amid the dynamic spirals of the plants. The drawing swirls with motion and energy. No element seems static. When Leonardo developed the drawing into a full painting, he changed the pose so that Leda was standing and her nude body appeared more lithe and gentle. She is turning her head slightly away from the swan and looking down demurely, yet at the same time she twists her upper body toward him. She caresses his neck. He wraps a wing firmly around her buttocks. Both exude a sensuous and sinuous beauty. That earthly and earthy sexuality makes the picture atypical. A non-religious narrative panel painting, assuming you do not consider the sexual exploits of Greek gods to be a religious subject, it was Leonardo's only overtly sexual or erotic scene. And yet, at least in the copies available to us today, it is not actually very erotic. Leonardo is not Titian. He never painted romance or eros. Instead, two themes dominate. The painting conveys a domestic and familial harmony, a pleasant portrayal of a couple at home by their lake, cuddling as they admire their newborns. It also goes beyond the erotic to focus on the tale's procreative aspects. From the lushness of the seeding plants to the fecundity of the soil and the hatching of the eggs, the painting is a celebration of the fertility of nature. Unlike the usual depictions of the Leda myth, Leonardo's is not about sex, but birth. These themes of generational and natural renewal apparently resonated with him now that he was in his mid-50s with no heirs. Around the time he began to paint Leda, he adopted Francesco Melzi, who painted the Leda copy shown as figure 81, to be his surrogate son and heir. Salvator Mundi. In 2011, a newly rediscovered painting by Leonardo surprised the art world. Each decade, a dozen or so pieces are proposed or pushed as having a reasonable claim to be previously unknown Leonardo's, but only twice before in modern times had such assertions ended up generally accepted. The Benoit Madonna oil painting in Moscow's Hermitage that was publicly revealed in 1909, and the chalk drawing La Bella Principessa that Kemp and others asserted as authentic a century later. This 2011 addition to the list of autograph works is a painting known as Salvator Mundi, Saviour of the World, with Jesus gesturing in blessing with his right hand while holding a solid crystal orb in his left. See figure 83. The Salvator Mundi motif, which features Christ with an orb topped by a cross, known as a Globus Crucigere, had become very popular by the early 1500s, especially among northern European painters. Leonardo's version contains some of his distinctive features, a figure that manages to be at once both reassuring and unsettling, a mysterious straight-on stare, an elusive smile, cascading curls, and sfumato softness. Before the painting was authenticated, there was historic evidence that one like it existed. In the inventory of Salai's estate was a painting of Christ in the manner of God the Father. Such a piece was catalogued in the collections of the English King Charles I, who was beheaded in 1649, and also Charles II, who restored the monarchy in 1660. The historical trail of Leonardo's version was lost after the painting passed from Charles II to the Duke of Buckingham, whose son sold it in 1763. But a historic reference remained. The widow of Charles I had commissioned Wenceslaus Hollar to make an etching of the painting. There were also at least 20 copies painted by some of Leonardo's followers. The trail of the painting reappeared in 1900, when it was acquired by a British collector who did not suspect that it was by Leonardo. It had been damaged, overpainted, and so heavily varnished that it was unrecognizable, and it was attributed to Leonardo's student Boltraffio. The work was later catalogued as a copy of Boltraffio's copy. When the collector's estate sold it at auction in 1958, it fetched less than $100. The painting was sold again in 2005 to a consortium of art dealers and collectors who believed that it might be more than just a copy of a Leonardo painting. As with the tale of La Bella Principessa, the subsequent authentication process reveals a lot about Leonardo's work. The consortium brought it to a Manhattan art historian and dealer named Robert Simon, who oversaw a 5-year process of cleaning it carefully and quietly showing it to experts. Among those consulted were Nicholas Penny, then director of London's National Gallery, and Carmen Bumbach of New York's Metropolitan Museum. It was brought to London in 2008 so that it could be directly compared with the National Gallery's version of Virgin of the Rocks by other experts, including Luke Sison, who was then curator of Italian paintings at the gallery, David Alan Brown of Washington's National Gallery of Art, and Pietro Marani, professor of art history at the Politecnico di Milano. And, of course, a call went out to Martin Kemp, who was also then authenticating La Bella Principessa. "We've got something I think you would want to look at," Penny told Kemp. When Kemp saw it, he was struck by the orb and hair. "It had that kind of presence that Leonardo's have," he recalled. But it was not merely gut, intuition and connoisseurship that authenticated Salvator Mundi. The painting duplicated almost precisely the 1650 Wenceslaus Hollar engraving that had been made from the original. It had the same snaking and lustrous curls, the same Leonardo-esque knot pattern on the sashes, and the irregular pleats on Christ's blue cloak that are also in Leonardo's preparatory drawings. These similarities, however, were not dispositive. There were many copies made by Leonardo's followers. Was it possible that this newly rediscovered painting was also a copy? Technical analysis helped to answer that. After the picture was cleaned, high-resolution photos and X-rays helped reveal a pentimento showing that the thumb of Jesus' right hand had originally been placed differently. That is not something a copyist would need to do. In addition, shining an infrared light that reflected off the white priming of the panel showed that the painter had pressed his palm against the wet paint above Christ's left eye to achieve a sfumato blurring, which was a distinctive Leonardo technique. The work had been painted on walnut, just like other Leonardos of the period, in many very thin layers of almost translucent paint. By that point, most of the experts agreed that it was an authentic Leonardo. As a result, The art consortium was able to sell it for close to $80 million in 2013 to a Swiss art dealer who then resold it to a Russian fertilizer billionaire for $127 million. Unlike other Salvator Mundi paintings, Leonardo's offers the viewer shifting emotional interactions, similar to those found in the Mona Lisa. The misty aura and blurred sfumato lines, especially of the lips, produces a psychological mystery and an ambiguous smile that seems to change slightly with each new look. Is there a hint of a smile? Look again. Is Jesus staring at us or into the distance? Move from side to side and ask again. The curling hair, coiled with energy, seems to spring into motion as it reaches the shoulders, as if Leonardo were painting the eddies of a flowing stream. They become more distinct and less soft as they reach the chest. This stems from his studies of acuity perspective. Objects that are closer to a viewer are less blurred. Around the time he was working on Salvator Mundi, Leonardo was doing his optics studies that explored how the eyes focus. He knew that he could create the illusion of three-dimensional depth in a painting by making the objects in the foreground sharper. The two fingers on Christ's right hand that are closest to us are drawn with a crisper delineation. It makes the hand pop out toward us, as if it's in motion and giving us a blessing. Leonardo would reuse this technique a few years later with the pointing hands in two depictions of St. John the Baptist. There is, however, a puzzling anomaly in the painting, one that seems to be an unusual lapse or unwillingness by Leonardo to link art and science. It involves the clear crystal orb that Jesus is holding. In one respect, it is rendered with beautiful scientific precision. There are three jagged bubbles in it that have the irregular shape of the tiny gaps in crystal called inclusions. Around that time, Leonardo had evaluated rock crystals as a favor for Isabella d'Este, who was planning to purchase some, and he captured accurately the twinkle of inclusions. In addition, he included a deft and scientifically accurate touch, showing he had tried to get the image correct. The part of Jesus' palm pressing into the bottom of the orb is flattened and lighter, as it would indeed appear in reality. But Leonardo failed to paint the distortion that would occur when looking through a solid clear orb at objects that are not touching the orb. Solid glass or crystal, whether shaped like an orb or a lens, produces magnified, inverted, and reversed images. Instead, Leonardo painted the orb as if it were a hollow glass bubble that does not refract or distort the light passing through it. At first glance, it seems as if the heel of Christ's palm displays a hint of refraction. But a closer look shows the slight double image occurs even in the part of the hand not behind the orb. It is merely a pentimenti that occurred when Leonardo decided to shift slightly the hand's position. Christ's body and the folds of his robe are not inverted or distorted when seen through the orb. At issue is a complex optical phenomenon. Try it with a solid glass ball. See figure 84. A hand touching the orb will not appear to be distorted. But things viewed through the orb that are an inch or so away, such as Christ's robes, will be seen as inverted and reversed. The distortion varies depending on the distance of the objects from the orb. If Leonardo had accurately depicted the distortions, the palm touching the orb would have remained the way he painted it, but hovering inside the orb would be a reduced and inverted mirror image of Christ's robes and arm. Why did Leonardo not do this? It is possible that he had not noticed or surmised how light is refracted in a solid sphere. But I find that hard to believe. He was at the time deep into his optics studies, and how light reflects and refracts was an obsession. Scores of notebook pages are filled with diagrams of light bouncing around at different angles. I suspect that he knew full well how an object seen through a crystal orb would appear distorted, but he chose not to paint it that way. Either because he thought it would be a distraction, it would indeed have looked very weird, or because he was subtly trying to impart a miraculous quality to Christ and his orb. Chapter 23. Cesare Borgia. Ruthless Warrior. Ludovico Sforza, Leonardo's patron in Milan, had a reputation for ruthlessness that included, among other alleged acts, poisoning his nephew in order to seize the ducal crown. But Ludovico was a choir boy compared to Leonardo's next patron, Cesare Borgia. Name any odious activity and Borgia was the master of it. Murder, treachery, incest, debauchery, wanton cruelty, betrayal and corruption. He had a brutal tyrant's hunger for power combined with a sociopath's thirst for blood. Once, when he felt he had been libeled, he had the offender's tongue cut out, his right hand chopped off, and the hand with the tongue attached to its little finger hung from a church window. His only sliver of historical redemption, which is undeserved, came when Machiavelli used him as a model of cunning in The Prince and taught that his ruthlessness was a tool for power. Cesare Borgia was the son of the Spanish-Italian Cardinal Rodrigo Borgia, soon to become Pope Alexander VI, who vies for the hotly contested title of most libertine Renaissance Pope. He had in the fullest measure all the vices of the flesh and of the spirit, the Pope's contemporary Francesco Guicciardini wrote. He was the first Pope to recognize openly his illegitimate children, 10 in all, including Cesare and Lucrezia, by multiple mistresses, and he was able to get Cesare a dispensation from his illegitimacy so he could hold church offices. He made Cesare the Bishop of Pamplona at 15 and a cardinal 3 years later, even though the son showed less than zero predilection for piety. In fact, he had not even taken holy orders. Preferring to be a ruler rather than a religious figure, Cesare became the first person in history to fully resign from the cardinalate, and he likely had his brother stabbed to death and thrown into the Tiber so that he could replace him as the commander of the papal forces. In that capacity, he forged an alliance with the French, and he was with King Louis XII marching into Milan in 1499. The day after their arrival, they went to see the Last Supper, and there Borgia first met Leonardo. Knowing Leonardo, it is likely that during the next few weeks, he showed Borgia his military engineering designs. Borgia subsequently launched a plan to carve out his own principality in the politically tumultuous Romagna region that stretched east of Florence to the Adriatic coast. These lands were supposed to be under his father, the Pope, but the towns were controlled by their own independent princes, little tyrants and vicars. Their violent rivalries regularly erupted into frenzied sieges and sackings accompanied by rampant rape and murder. By the spring of 1501, Borgia had conquered Imola, Forli, Pesaro, Faenza, Rimini and Cesena. Borgia next set his sights on Florence, which cowered in dread. Its treasury was depleted, and it had no military to defend it. In May 1501, as his forces neared Florence's walls, the ruling signoria of the city capitulated by agreeing to pay Borgia 36,000 florins a year as protection money, and permitting his army to cross Florentine territory at will as he conquered more towns. Niccolò Machiavelli. The bribe bought Florence peace for a year, but in June 1502 Borgia was back. As his army sacked more surrounding towns, he commanded the leaders of Florence to send a delegation to hear his latest demands. Two people were selected to try to deal with him. The elder was Francesco Soderini, a wily church leader who led one of the anti-Medici factions in Florence. Accompanying him was the son of a bankrupt lawyer, well-educated but poor, whose writing skills and savvy understanding of power games had established him as Florence's cleverest young diplomat, Niccolò Machiavelli. Machiavelli had a smile right out of a Leonardo painting, enigmatic, at times laconic, always appearing to hide a secret. He shared with Leonardo the trait of being a sharp observer. He was not yet a famous author, but already he was known for his ability to produce lucid reports informed by insights into power balances, tactics, and personal motivations. He became a valued civil servant and secretary of Florence's chancery. As soon as he left Florence, Machiavelli received word that Borgia was in Urbino, a town east of Florence, between the Apennine Mountains and the Adriatic coast. Borgia had captured Urbino through trickery, by feigning friendship and then striking unexpectedly. He arrives in one place before anyone knows he has left the other, Machiavelli reported in a dispatch, and is able to install himself in someone else's house before anyone else noticed it. As soon as they arrived in Urbino, Soderini and Machiavelli were ushered into the ducal palace. Borgia knew how to put on a power show. He was seated in a dark room, his bearded and pockmarked face lit by a single candle. He insisted that Florence show him respect and support. Once again, a vague accommodation seems to have been reached, and Borgia did not attack. A few days later, probably as part of his arrangement with Florence that Machiavelli had helped to negotiate, Borgia secured the services of the city's most famous artist and engineer, Leonardo da Vinci. Leonardo and Borgia. Leonardo may have gone to work with Borgia at the behest of Machiavelli and Florence's leaders as a gesture of goodwill, similar to the way he had been dispatched 20 years earlier to Milan as a diplomatic gesture to Ludovico Sforza. Or he may have been sent as a way for Florence to have an agent embedded with Borgia's forces. Maybe it was both. But either way, Leonardo was no mere pawn or agent. He would not have gone to work for Borgia unless he wanted to. On the first page of a pocket-sized notebook he took on his journey in service of Borgia, Leonardo listed the equipment he packed: a pair of compasses, a sword belt, a light hat, a book of white paper for drawing, a leather vest, and a swimming belt. The last item was something he had earlier described among his military inventions. Have a coat made of leather, which must be double across the breast, that is, having a hem on each side of about a finger breadth, he wrote. When you want to leap into the sea, blow out the skirt of your coat through the double hems. Even though Borgia was in Urbino, Leonardo first headed southwest from Florence to Piombino, a coastal town that was occupied by Borgia's army. Apparently he had received orders from Borgia to make an inspection tour of the forts in Borgia's control. In addition to studying the fortifications, he looked at ways to drain the marshes and, easily gliding back and forth between practical engineering and pure scientific curiosity, made a study of the movements of the waves and tides. From there, he headed eastward across the Apennine Mountains to the other side of the Italian peninsula, gathering topographical data for maps and observing landscapes and bridges that would later be reflected in the Mona Lisa. Finally, in midsummer 1502, he arrived in Urbino to join Borgia, almost 3 years after meeting him in Milan. Leonardo sketched the staircase of Urbino's palace and the dovecote, and he made a series of three red chalk drawings that were likely of Borgia. See figure 85 in the PDF. The left-handed hatch lines of the drawing accentuate the shadows under Borgia's eyes. He looks pensive and subdued, his ringlets of curly beard covering a face that has become thickened with age and perhaps pockmarked by his syphilis. He no longer looks like the handsomest man in Italy, as he was once called. Perhaps Borgia looked pensive because he was worried, rightly, that the King of France, Louis XII, was hedging his support for Borgia and promising protection to the Florentines. Swirling around the French court and the Vatican were intriguers who had been betrayed or divorced by various Borgias and were now seeking revenge. A week or so after his arrival in Urbino, Leonardo jotted in his notebook, "Where is Valentino?" using a nickname for Borgia who had been made the Duke of Valentinois by the French king. Borgia, it turned out, had disguised himself as a knight hospitaller and snuck away with three trusted guards to ride north at a furious pace to reinstate himself in the good graces of Louis, which he did. Borgia had not forgotten Leonardo. When he reached Pavia, where Louis was then holding court, he issued a floridly written passport for Leonardo, giving him special privileges and rites of passage, dated August 18, 1502. To all our lieutenants, castellans, captains, condottieri, soldiers and subjects, who may be shown this document, you are hereby ordered and commanded on behalf of our most eminent and well-beloved familial friend, Dilectissimo Familiare, the architect and engineer general Leonardo Vinci, bearer of these documents, who has received our commission to inspect all the strong points and fortresses in our dominion, so that he may, according to their needs, provide for their maintenance. He shall be given free passage and be relieved of all public tax, both for himself and for his party, and shall be welcomed amicably, and may make measurements and examine whatever he pleases. For this purpose, provide him with as many men as he requisitions, and grant him all the help, succor, and favor he may demand. For it is our will that every engineer in our dominions shall be bound to confer with him and follow his advice. And let no man dare to do the contrary, if he does not wish to incur our extreme displeasure. Borgia's passport described Leonardo as he had fancied himself ever since his letter to the Duke of Milan 20 years earlier, as a military engineer and innovator rather than a painter. He had been warmly embraced in fulsome and familial terms by the most vibrant warrior of the age. For the moment, the man who had been described as no longer able to bear the sight of a brush got to play the role of a man of action. Borgia left Pavia to rejoin his army in September, and Leonardo travelled with him eastward as he captured Fossombrone, using a combination of trickery, betrayal, and surprise. That taught Leonardo a lesson about designs for the interiors of castles and fortresses. Be sure that the escape tunnel does not lead to the inner fortress, lest the fortress be captured by treachery or betrayal of the Lord. He also suggested that fortress walls be curved because that would reduce the impact of cannonballs. Percussion is less strong the more oblique it is, he wrote. He then accompanied Borgia's army as it marched towards the Adriatic coast. In the town of Rimini, he was enthralled by the harmony of the different falls of water. A few days later, in the port of Cesenatico, he sketched the harbour and drew up plans for defending the dikes, so that they are not vulnerable to artillery fire. He also directed that the harbour be dredged so that it would stay linked to the sea. Always enthralled by ambitious water projects, he looked at ways the harbour canal could be extended 10 miles inland to Cesena. While in Cesena, which Borgia had made the capital of his Romagna region conquests, Leonardo made a drawing of the fortress. But by then his mind was wandering from military matters. He sketched a house window with a quarter-circle pane on top, which reflected his interest in curved and rectilinear geometric shapes, and a hook with 2 bunches of grapes. This is how they carry grapes in Cesena, he explained. He also combined the compositional eye of a painter with that of an engineer to note how the workmen digging a ditch array themselves in a pyramid. He was not impressed with the engineering intelligence of the locals, at one point drawing a cart and saying of the Cesena region, "In Romagna, the chief realm of all stupidity, capo d'ogni grossezza d'ingegno, vehicles with 4 wheels are used, in which the 2 in front are small and the 2 high ones behind, an arrangement that is very unfavourable to motion, because on the front wheels more weight is laid than on those behind." Ideas for building better wheelbarrows was a topic he had covered in one of his draft treatises on mechanics. The mathematician Luca Pacioli later recounted a tale of Leonardo in action. One day Cesare Borgia found himself and his army at a river that was 24 paces wide and could find no bridge nor any material to make one except for a stack of wood all cut to a length of 16 paces, Pacioli wrote, probably based on hearing the story from Leonardo. From this wood, using neither iron nor rope nor any other construction, his noble engineer made a bridge sufficiently strong for the army to pass over. A sketch for such a self-supporting bridge in Leonardo's notebook has 7 short poles and 10 longer, each notched so they can be fit together at the seam. See figure 86 and a fainter version in figure 53. As the fall of 1502 approached, Borgia moved his court to the highly fortified town of Imola, 30 miles inland from Cesena on the road to Bologna. Leonardo made notes of the fortress compound, noting that its moat was 40 feet deep and its walls 15 feet thick. In front of the only entrance through the walls surrounding the town was a moat split by a man-made island. Anyone trying to invade had to cross two bridges and be exposed to a defensive barrage. Borgia's plan was to turn the town into his permanent military headquarters by having Leonardo make it even more impregnable. Machiavelli arrived on October the 7th, sent by Florence to be an emissary and informant. In his daily dispatches back to Florence, which he knew were being read by Borgia's intelligence agents, Machiavelli apparently refers to Leonardo only as another who is also acquainted with Cesare's secrets, and as a friend whose knowledge is worthy of attention. Imagine the scene. For 3 months during the winter of 1502-3, as if in a historical fantasy movie, three of the most fascinating figures of the Renaissance, a brutal and power-crazed son of a pope, a sly and amoral writer-diplomat, and a dazzling painter yearning to be an engineer, were holed up in a tiny fortified walled town that was approximately 5 blocks wide and 8 blocks long. While he was in Imola, with Machiavelli and Borgia, Leonardo made what may be his greatest contribution to the art of war. It is a map of Imola, but not any ordinary map. See figure 87. It is a work of beauty, innovative style, and military utility. It combines, in his inimitable manner, art and science. Drawn in ink with coloured washes and black chalk, the Imola map was an innovative step in cartography. The moat around the fortified town is tinted a subtle blue, the walls are silvery, and the roofs of the houses brick red. The aerial view is from directly overhead, unlike most maps of the time. On the edges, he has specified the distances to nearby towns, useful information for military campaigns, but written in his elegant mirror script, indicating that the version that survives is a copy he made for himself rather than Borgia. Leonardo used a magnetic compass, and the 8 major directional lines, north, northwest, west, southwest, etc., are shown with fine strokes. On a preliminary sketch, he marked the position and size of each house. The map is folded many times, indicating he tucked it in his pocket or pouch as he and his assistants paced off the distances. Around this time, he perfected the odometer he had been developing to measure long distances. See figure 88. On a cart, he mounted a vertical cog wheel, which looks like the front wheel of a wheelbarrow, that intersects with a horizontal cog wheel. Every time the vertical wheel completed a revolution, it would move the horizontal wheel a notch, and that would cast a stone into a container. On his drawing of the device, Leonardo noted that it makes the ear hear the sound of a little stone falling into a basin. The Imola map and others Leonardo made at the time would have been of great use to Borgia, whose victories came from conducting lightning strikes and, in the words of Machiavelli, being able to install himself in someone else's house before anyone else noticed it. Acting as an artist-engineer, Leonardo had devised a new military weapon, accurate, detailed, and easily read maps. Over the years, visually clear maps would become a key component of warfare. For example, the U.S. National Geospatial Intelligence Agency, originally known as the Defense Mapping Agency, had 14,500 employees and an annual budget exceeding $5 billion in 2017. Projected on the walls of its headquarters are maps combining accuracy with beauty, some of which bear a striking resemblance to Leonardo's map of Imola. In a larger sense, Leonardo's maps are another example of one of his greatest, though underappreciated, innovations, devising new methods for the visual display of information. In his illustrations for Pacioli's book on geometry, Leonardo was able to show models of a variety of polyhedrons that were perfectly shaded to look three-dimensional. In his notebook entries on engineering and mechanics, he drew pieces of machinery with subtlety and precision, adding cutaway shots of various components. He was among the first to deconstruct complex mechanisms and make separate drawings of each element. Likewise, in his anatomy drawings, he drew muscles, nerves, bones, organs, and blood vessels from different angles, and he pioneered the method of depicting them in multiple layers, like the transparencies of body layers found in encyclopedias centuries later. Leaving Borgia. In December 1502, Cesare Borgia committed a typical act of brutality. He had empowered a deputy, Ramiro de Lorca, to tyrannize Cesena and the surrounding territories with unremitting cruelty and gruesome slaughter to intimidate the populace. But once Ramiro had inspired enough fear, Borgia realized that it would be useful to sacrifice him. The day after Christmas, he had Ramiro brought to the central square in Cesena and sliced in two. The pieces of his body remained there on display. Cesare Borgia decided that there was no more need for this excessive power, Machiavelli later explained in The Prince. To purge the minds of the people and to win them over, Cesare determined to show the people that Ramiro's cruelties were inflicted by him and not Cesare. One morning, Ramiro's body was found cut in two pieces on the piazza at Cesena, with a block of wood and a bloody knife beside it. The brutality of this spectacle kept the people of the Romagna appeased and stupefied. The coldness of Borgia's brutality impressed Machiavelli, who called it an example that deserves close study and imitation by others. Borgia then marched on the coastal town of Senigallia, where local leaders had rebelled against his occupation. He offered them a meeting to negotiate a reconciliation, and he promised that they could keep their leadership roles if they pledged to be loyal. They agreed. But when Borgia arrived, he had the men seized and strangled to death, then ordered that the town be pillaged. By this point, even the cold-blooded and calculating Machiavelli was getting a bit squeamish. "The sack of the town continues, although it is now the 23rd hour," he scribbled in a dispatch. "I am much troubled." One of the strangled men was a friend of Leonardo, Vitellozzo Vitelli, who had lent him a book by Archimedes. Leonardo travelled with Borgia's army for the conquest of Siena a few weeks later, but his notebook suggests that he had mentally tuned out Borgia's horrors by focusing on other matters. He made a sketch of the church bell at Siena, 20 feet in diameter, and described the manner of its movement and the position of the attachment of its clapper. A few days later, shortly after Machiavelli had been recalled to Florence, Leonardo left Borgia's service. By March 1503, he was settled back in Florence and withdrawing money from his bank account at the hospital of Santa Maria Nuova. "Save me from strife and battle, a most beastly madness," Leonardo once wrote. Yet for 8 months he had put himself at Borgia's service and travelled with his armies. Why would a person whose notebook aphorisms decry killing and whose personal morality led him to be a vegetarian go to work for the most brutal murderer of the era? Partly this choice reflects Leonardo's pragmatism. In a land where the Medici, Sforzas, and Borgias jostled for power, Leonardo was able to time his patronage affiliations well and know when to move on. But there is more. Even as he remained aloof from most current events, he seemed to be attracted to power. It would take a Freudian analyst to explain Leonardo's affinity for attaching himself to strong men, and once again Freud himself tried to do so. He believed that Leonardo gravitated to them as substitutes for the manly but often absent father of his childhood. A simpler explanation is that Leonardo, who had just turned 50, had dreamed for more than 2 decades of being a military engineer. As Isabella d'Este's agent reported, he was tired of painting. Borgia had just turned 26. He combined bravado and elegance. "This lord is truly splendid and magnificent, and in war there is no enterprise so great that it does not seem small to him," Machiavelli wrote after meeting him. Indifferent to the shifting political agendas of Italy, yet attracted to military engineering and strong men, Leonardo had a chance to live out his military fantasies, which he did, until he realized they could become nightmares. Chapter 24. Hydraulic Engineer. Diverting the Arno. In his job application to Ludovico Sforza, Leonardo had boasted of his talent for guiding water from one place to another. That was, at best, an exaggeration. When he first arrived in Milan in 1482, he had done no hydraulic engineering, but like many of his fantasy aspirations, he willed this one into reality. During his years in Milan, he diligently studied the city's system of canals, and he recorded in his notebooks details of the mechanisms of the locks and other feats of water engineering. In particular, he was fascinated by the city's artificial canals, including the Naviglio Grande, begun in the 12th century, and the Naviglio Martesana, which was under construction while he lived there. Milan's waterworks had existed for centuries, even before the Romans built their famed aqueducts in the Po Valley around 200 BC. The flow of water each spring from the melting snow of the Alps was carefully managed in accordance with rules devised by ancient tribes to create controlled floods for the grain fields. Irrigation networks were created and canals were built that both channeled water and facilitated barge shipping. By the time Leonardo moved to Milan, the system of large canals was 3 centuries old, and the duchy there raised much of its revenue from the sale of water allocations. Leonardo himself was, at one point, compensated with a water allocation, and his design for an ideal city near Milan was based on using man-made canals and waterways. In Florence, by contrast, there had been no major hydraulic work since ancient times. The city had few canals, drainage projects, irrigation systems, or river diversions. With the knowledge he had soaked up in Milan and his fascination with the flow of water, he set out to change that. In his notebooks, he began sketching ways that Florence could copy Milan. Florence had controlled the town of Pisa, just over 50 miles down the Arno River toward the coast of the Mediterranean, for much of the 15th century. This was critical for Florence, which had no other outlet to the sea. But in 1494, Pisa managed to wriggle away and become a free republic. Florence's middling army was incapable of breaching Pisa's walls, and it could not successfully blockade the town because the Arno gave it access to supplies from the sea. Just before Pisa broke away, a major world event made Florence even more eager to control a sea outlet. In March 1493, Christopher Columbus returned safely from his first voyage across the Atlantic Ocean, and the report of his discoveries quickly spread throughout Europe. This was soon followed by a flurry of other accounts of amazing explorations. Amerigo Vespucci, whose cousin Agostino worked with Machiavelli in the Florentine Chancery, helped supply Columbus's third voyage in 1498, and the following year he made his own voyage across the Atlantic, landing in what is now Brazil. Unlike Columbus, who thought he was finding a route to India, Vespucci correctly reported to his Florentine patrons that he had arrived at a new land which, for many reasons, we observe to be a continent. His correct surmise led to its being named America after him. The excitement over what portended to be a new age of exploration made Florence's desire to regain Pisa more urgent. In July 1503, a few months after he left Borgia's service, Leonardo was sent to join Florence's army at the fortress of Verrucca, a square fortification atop a rocky outcropping. Verrucca means wart, overlooking the Arno 7 miles east of Pisa. Leonardo da Vinci himself came here with his companions, and we showed him everything, and we think that he likes La Verrucca very much, a field commissary reported back to the Florentine authorities. He said that he was thinking of making it impregnable. An entry for an account book in Florence that month lists a set of expenses and then adds, "This money has been spent to provide 6 horse coaches and to pay the board expenses for the expedition with Leonardo in the territory of Pisa to divert the Arno from its course and take it away from Pisa." Diverting the Arno River from its course and taking it away from Pisa. It was an audacious way to reconquer the city without storming the wall or wielding any weapons. If the river could be channeled somewhere else, Pisa would be cut off from the sea and lose its source of supply. The primary advocates of the idea included the 2 clever friends who had been holed up together that past winter in Imola, Leonardo da Vinci and Niccolo Machiavelli. The river that is to be diverted from one course to another must be coaxed and not treated roughly or with violence, Leonardo wrote in his notebook. His plan was to dig a huge ditch, 32 feet deep, upriver from Pisa, and use dams to divert the water from the river into the ditch. To do this, a sort of dam must be inserted into the river, then another one further downstream jutting out beyond it, and similarly third, fourth, and fifth dams, so that the river may discharge itself into the channel made for it. This would require moving 1 million tons of earth, and Leonardo calculated the man-hours necessary by doing a detailed time and motion study, one of the first in history. He figured out everything from the weight of one shovel load of dirt, 25 pounds, to how many shovel loads would fill a wheelbarrow, 20. His answer? It would take approximately 1.3 million man-hours, or 540 men working 100 days, to dig the Arno diversion ditch. At first, he considered ways to use wheeled carts to carry the dirt away, showing why those with three wheels were more efficient than those with four. But he realized that it would be very difficult to push carts up the banks of a ditch, so he designed one of his ingenious machines, which features two crane-like arms that would move lines with 24 buckets. See figure 89 in the PDF. When a bucket deposited its dirt at the top of the bank of the ditch, a worker would get in it and ride down to keep the weights counterbalanced. Leonardo also designed a treadmill system to harness human power to move the cranes. When digging began on the diversion ditch in August 1504, it was overseen by a new waterworks engineer who revised Leonardo's plans and decided not to build the dirt-moving machine. Instead of one deep ditch, as Leonardo designed, the new engineer decided to dig two ditches and to make them shallower than the bed of the Arno, which Leonardo knew would not work. In fact, the ditches ended up being only 14 feet deep rather than the 32 feet that Leonardo had specified. After consulting Leonardo in Florence, Machiavelli wrote a blunt warning to the engineer. "We fear that the bed of the ditch is shallower than the bed of the Arno. This would have negative effects, and in our opinion, it would not direct the project to the end we wish." The warning was ignored, but it turned out to be well-founded. When the ditch was opened to the Arno, Machiavelli's assistant on the scene reported, "The waters never went through the ditches except when the river was in flood, and as soon as it subsided, the water flowed back." A few weeks later, in early October, a violent storm caused the walls of the ditches to collapse, flooding the nearby farms, but still not diverting the main course of the Arno. The project was abandoned. Even though it failed, the project to divert the Arno rekindled Leonardo's interest in a larger scheme, creating a navigable waterway between Florence and the Mediterranean Sea. Near Florence, the Arno River often silted up, and it also had a series of waterfalls and rapids that kept boats from passing. Leonardo's solution was to bypass that part of the river with a canal. Sluices should be made in the valley of La Chiana at Arezzo, so that when in the summer the Arno lacks water, the canal may not remain dry, he wrote. "Let this canal be 20 braccia, 40 feet, wide." The plan would help mills and agriculture in the surrounding region, he suggested, so other towns would likely fund it. Leonardo drew a variety of maps in 1504, showing how the canal would work. One of them, done with brush and ink, was pricked with pins, evidence that he had made copies. Another, done in delicate colour with arresting details of tiny towns and fortifications, showed his plan to turn the swampy marshes of the Val di Chiana into a reservoir. Figure 90. The fiasco of the Arno diversion project probably persuaded the cash-strapped Florentine leaders not to attempt something even more ambitious, so Leonardo's canal proposals were shelved. Draining the Piombino Marshes. The failure of these projects did not immediately persuade Leonardo to give up hydraulic engineering, nor did his patrons want him to. At the end of October 1504, just weeks after the Arno diversion was abandoned, he was sent by the Florentine authorities, at Machiavelli's request, to provide technical assistance to the ruler of Piombino, a port city 60 miles south of Pisa that Florence was seeking to turn into an ally. Leonardo had been to Piombino 2 years earlier while in the service of Cesare Borgia and had studied the fortifications and looked at ways to drain the surrounding marshes. On this second visit, he spent 2 months designing a series of fortifications, moats, and secret passageways that could be used if the ruler was betrayed, as happened at Fossombrone, a reference to Borgia's use of treachery in capturing that town. The centerpiece of Leonardo's design was a circular fortress. Inside, it had three rings of walls, with spaces between them that could be flooded and turned into moats during an attack. Leonardo had been studying the force exerted by objects hitting a wall at different angles, and he knew that the potency of a strike diminished as the angle became more oblique. Rounded walls, rather than straight ones, were thus more likely to deflect a cannonball. It was Leonardo's most remarkable conception in the field of military engineering and represented a total rethinking of the principles of fortification, Martin Kemp wrote. Nowhere are Leonardo's theoretical principles, his sense of form, and his observational acumen more brilliantly combined than in the circular fortress designs. Leonardo's hydraulic challenge at Piombino was draining the marshlands surrounding the castle. His first idea was to divert some muddy water from the river into the marsh and allow the silt, dirt, and pebbles to settle to build up the land, similar to what is now being attempted with the marshes in southern Louisiana. Shallow channels would drain away the clear surface water, allowing more muddy water to enter. Then he came up with another approach that was far more ambitious. At first glance, his plan may seem to skirt his blurred border with fantasy, but like many of his fantasies, the basic idea is a good one ahead of its time. Drawing on his love of vortexes and eddies and swirling water, he sketched a way to create a centrifugal pump in the sea that was near the marsh. The idea was to stir the seawater in a circular way and thus create an artificial whirlpool. Tubes could then be used to siphon the water from the swamp and have it be sucked into the vortex of the whirlpool, which would be lower than the level of the marsh. In two separate notebooks, Leonardo described and drew a method for drying up the swamps which border on the sea. The artificial whirlpool in the sea would be created by a board that is turned by an axle, and the siphon would expel its water at the back of the turning board. His drawings are extremely detailed, and even include the width and speed that would be required of the artificial whirlpool. Although it proved impractical, the theory was correct. Typical of Leonardo, he also jotted down some observations on colour and painting while in Piombino, observing closely the way sunlight and the reflected light from the sea coloured the hull of a ship. "I saw the greenish shadows cast by the ropes, mast and spars on a white wall as the sunlight struck it. The wall surface, which was not lit by the sun, took on the colour of the sea." The Arno projects, the circular fortress and the draining of the Piombino swamps, had one thing in common with many of Leonardo's grandest projects, and even some of his less grand ones. They never came to fruition. They showed Leonardo at his most fantastical, dreaming up schemes that darted back and forth across the boundaries of practicality. Like the construction of his flying machines, they were too fanciful to execute. This inability to ground his fantasies in reality has generally been regarded as one of Leonardo's major failings. Yet in order to be a true visionary, one has to be willing to overreach and to fail some of the time. Innovation requires a reality distortion field.